Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you have done.
Hello, world. This is Pamela Lane Lockridge. I'm with Stop Child Abuse Now, Blog Talk Radio Show, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. Today is May 19th. It's a Wednesday, a special guest night. And want to just remind everybody that this is, that May is Mental Health Awareness Month. And I'm going to ask my co-host, Penelope, to come on and tell us about the mission of NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, and give you the call-in number to be a panelist tonight with our guest, Dr. Laura McGuire. Penelope?
Thank you, Pamela. So please, if you're streaming and contemplating calling in, we'd encourage you to do so. It's going to be a great show, and you're going to have an opportunity to call in on the panel to interact with our very special guest tonight. The number to call in is area code 646-595-2118. Again, that's 646-595-2118. As you know, NASCA, which stands for National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, is all about child abuse trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA. It's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with two goals. The first, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. So, if you, again, if you'd like to call in and be a member of the panel, the number is 646-595-2118. Thank you, Pamela.
Thank you, Penelope. And, yes, we ask our panelists to come on. If there's any NASCA ambassadors out there, please come on and interact with our special guest tonight. And before further ado, I'm going to ask Dr. Laura McGuire. I'm going to unmute her mic and ask her to come on. And I'm going to ask her to introduce herself. She's from New York City.
Dr. Hello. McGuire. Thank you so much for having me on. I am so happy to be back on this show. I was, I think we had a monthly segment, and that was back in 2018, I think. And I have stayed close to a lot of the people at NASCA and am so happy to be facilitating this conversation with you guys tonight. As you mentioned, my name is Dr. Laura McGuire. I actually now live in Florida. Back when I was starting out doing this, I was in New York. but I live in Florida now, and I run the National Center for Equity and Agency, which is a consulting firm that is fully staffed by survivors and scholars, and we try to get these important messages out to the people who need them, whether that's fellow survivors and advocates, or that's people in positions of power, and making the world a little bit more trauma-informed and facilitating healing for survivors at any age.
Oh, my goodness, what a mouthful. And I'm so proud of what you're doing, because it is so needed today. I mean, we are in the midst of breaking open with the Me Too movement and all these people that are being exposed, these big-name people that are being exposed with you know, their sex crimes and everything. Dr. Laura, it is spot on that we have you on tonight.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and I had reached out again when my book came out, Creating Cultures of Consent, because one of my goals is to make sure there are real tangible resources, particularly for people who are working with youth, whether they're small children or teenagers, and to, you know, focus primarily at this point on providing resources for prevention. And like I said, we also work a lot with adults and those who are serving adults who are talking about previous abuse or current things that they are processing and living through. But prevention is always the goal, right? If we can prevent things, that's what we want to do. And so I wrote the book, Creating Cultures of Consent, A Guide for Educators and Parents, because I looked all around as a parent, as an educator, and as a survivor, and just couldn't find something that really said, here's some things to say, here's things you can do, here's how you want to facilitate these conversations with young people so that it's not overwhelming or awkward or scary, but something that everyone feels like they have a stake in and that they can take a part of. And by doing that, hopefully we make this world a much better place for young people and for adult survivors as well.
Absolutely. And I like what you're doing as far as inclusiveness. I have a master's in social work, so, you know, I have to be culturally sensitive, and we have to be inclusive, all inclusive of all cultures, all communities. Mm-hmm. You know, everywhere this reaches, it's like, to me, abuse is like an octopus with all the tentacles of, you know, domestic violence, child trauma, rape. I mean, it's just so much. Trafficking, you know, it's just so many tentacles and so many offshoots of the main abuse.
Yeah, that's such a good point.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I like that you're, you know, not a survivor of child abuse. And we don't usually have, this is unusual, we don't usually have a special guest that doesn't have a story, but we absolutely need to have somebody come on that can look from the outside in. Instead of always being subjective and telling our story, we need objectivity. And I think you bring that to the table. So I'm going to give you the mic, and you start where you feel comfortable. And if you don't mind, when you tell us the name of your book, can you slow it down a little bit so people can write the name down?
Sure, yes. So, as I mentioned, my book is called Creating Cultures of Consent. And as you mentioned, it's about how do we shift this as a cultural norm, right? Because so much of the trauma that we see in the world and that is experienced by millions of people is based on cultural norms. Or even if you might say, oh, no, child abuse is not normal in my culture at all. We stand against that. We always have. But a lot of times behaviors, expectations, privilege of protecting predators is actually normalized, even if on the outside we're saying that's wrong, that the scripts, as we call it in psychology and sociology, the scripts that we have are sometimes quite the opposite, and that's how these things can really fester and grow. And like you're saying, it has tentacles. I often say it's like a systemic infection, right? And that infection is coursing through the entire body. And a lot of times what we want to do is put Band-Aids on top of it and just cover it up over and over again and say, see, we're doing something. But we're not actually getting to the root of the problem, right? We're not addressing that infection. And to do so takes a lot more work. We have to really clean out everything that's kind of causing the bacteria of abuse to grow and then really suture that wound, do the hard work of healing as individuals, as communities, as systems. And I know you're a social worker of the micro, macro, and meso perspectives on that. And that is so crucial. So, I did not experience child abuse myself, but I have many survivors in my family, and I am a survivor of domestic violence. So I understand, you know, many of the kind of universal aspects that all survivors go through, and I think I very much centralize that in my work. That's why I got into this field, right? I went through deep trauma and had to figure out how to even name that, how to identify it as survivors. So often that and hardest step in our journey is really identifying what we've survived as not okay, not acceptable, despite what our abusers told us. And even sometimes what society, our family, our church, et cetera, has told us and said, oh, it's not that bad. Or, you know, you just had to accept that because that person had that position of power over you. So I took my lived experience and the lived experience of the people in my family and then became an educator and started working with young people who were going through trauma, who were identified as at-risk youth. Many of them were in and out of the juvenile justice system. And I started talking about my story in working with them as a teacher and talking about surviving domestic violence. And, you know, even though I had many positive aspects in my childhood, this was not something that was really discussed. And I didn't really have sometimes the best models for creating effective boundaries or for seeing healthy relationships modeled for me, right? A lot of it was, well, you just have to make it work, especially as someone who is growing up socialized as a woman, right? You have to try to appease someone, don't say anything that's going to upset them, try to make everything smooth over, be the bigger person, right? And so it kind of set me up, though it certainly wasn't anyone's intention, but it set me up to be much more likely to be approached and identified by a predator. And that's exactly what happened. You know, they saw, okay, this person's, you know, been told their whole life, do whatever you can to make someone else happy and try to appease them. And, you know, if someone's being cruel to you, you have to try to make things right. And, you know, and that gave me that unhealthy expectation to then also stay and try to fix things and think that I could fix things. And so then, again, explaining that to young people, I noticed that they were going through the same thing and that many of them had survived childhood trauma and were surviving dating and relationship abuse because, again, they were being told, you know, this is just normal. And if someone, you know, makes you feel less than, if someone belittles you, if someone threatens you, if you feel scared and tense all the time, well, that's just relationships. And, you know, anything else is just a fantasy. And so I really focused on how do I create messages that young people in particular feel are real, right? They don't feel like, oh, you don't understand. They know that, yes, we do understand that this is hard to comprehend, and especially if that wasn't modeled for you at home. And then what is the alternative, right? And that's always what I try to focus on, because I think if you inundate people, especially survivors, too much with the negative or statistics or other terrible stories, that doesn't really do anything good. Instead, it's focusing on affirming their experience, affirming that they don't deserve to be treated that way or anything that they've survived is never their fault. And talk about, well, what is something else look like, whether it's a relationship or it's even the way we view ourselves, our bodies, our identities, our experiences after surviving trauma, and really helping them imagine, how can I get to that place where this alternative is my reality, where I have an expectation of consent, where I have an expectation of bodily autonomy and effective communication with my partners, and I never feel scared or hurt or put down. And then also doing that work inside themselves to redefine what that looks like and how they're going to define healthy and safe and all of these different things for themselves, right? And that's where also culture comes in, because we are all intersectional beings. And so if I go and I say a healthy relationship looks like having conversations like this example, and I give one example, well, someone might say, but, you know, that doesn't seem really culturally applicable to me. That's not really how I communicate in my family or in my country or in, you know, even a spiritual community. And so we want to maintain what is healthy and what is good for people universally, but then also make it adaptive that, yes, this is going to look slightly different for different people, even different ages, coming from different generations, and different gender expressions and identities, all these different things, right, go into that you have to still make this something that is customized and applicable to you as an individual, while, again, maintaining those core principles that we want for all human beings everywhere. And so those are the conversations I facilitate now. Yes.
Okay. I'm thinking while you're talking, is this in your book? Is this like chapters in your book and you've got this all laid out, outlined, you know, within
yes.
your book?
Yes, so that's
okay.
a great question.
Would you think it appropriate to open your book and just read the chapter titles to us?
Oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Hold on, let me go get it. But no, that's a great point. So in my book, I touch a little bit on my personal story. And again, you know, even the messages we get growing up and how they can contribute to being more likely to face violence. I very much lay out what those
okay.
next steps are.
And before you do that, mm-hmm. I have one more question. Did you witness any of, you said it was, you know, you helping your family get through some things. Did you witness anybody in your family being abused sexually, violently, verbally, physically, mentally, spiritually? Did you witness any of that from any of your cousins?
Yeah. No, I think that I witnessed a lot of unhealthy boundaries and people not feeling like they had a voice in relationships. And some of that, especially in extended family, I could say now, definitely was treading into an abusive dynamic. And again, I didn't really have a strong model of an alternative to that. So that was definitely
okay.
true for me. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, later on, as I got older and as I especially started to get into this work, that's when people more disclosed things to me in my family, in my friends I was close to growing up that I wasn't witnessing, right, but that were going on or had gone on in their life. And that was a really profound experience too, because I realized, you know, these things can be going on all around us in so many households, in so many ways, and we might not even be aware of it till later.
right. Like, I was sexually abused from the age of 4 to 18. My mother actually put me out to her second husband. And my sister witnessed some of the abuse, and today she is still affected by it. I mean, it traumatized her more than it traumatized me. I got healed. Can't say that's true, but, you know, she never thought she needed help because she wasn't the one, you know, but I'm telling you, vicariously, you can really be damaged mentally.
Yes. Yes. Thank you for bringing it up, and I'm so sorry for what you went through, and we definitely have to talk more about vicarious and secondary trauma, right? Because that's what people will say to themselves. Well, I wasn't the exact victim, so I don't deserve to get help. Or, you know, I don't deserve it because it could be so much worse. I could have been that person in my family who was the target. But they can experience so many of the exact same symptoms and, you know, traumas, and then having to process that as an adult, as if they were the person who it was being done to directly. So we want all those people who have any connection to trauma to, you know, seek out help and support to get through that. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's system theory right there in a nutshell, isn't it? System theory.
Yes.
When one part of the system is affected, it affects the whole system. And that's why we need to reach, if we can reach one within the system and get them healed, it could break the cycle up above and below. You know, if it's a team, they can open up the eyes of any of their older generation or the younger generation, you know, within their family system.
Yeah.
So what's
exactly
your chapters?
All right. So chapter one is called Why Consent? And it really goes through, like I said, a lot of my kind of personal narrative and how do we even teach these topics, right? Because you can't just say, you know, hey, kids, here's something that's important and you should take this on as a cultural norm and that's it. You know, we have to make sure that these conversations are, one, age appropriate, right, for different age groups, and that they build on each other. So hopefully we're planting these seeds with young children with respect and boundaries and their rights to their own bodies and feelings of respect emotionally and physically in all aspects. And then that's growing, right? As they develop, how do we help them understand how that then applies to romantic relationships and friendships and family and all of the different dynamics that they'll face. So we also talk a little bit about the history of these conversations in the United States and how that's continued, and then give some insight into where parents continue to struggle. So I did a survey when I started writing this book and asked parents online, you know, if they were having these conversations at all. And most of them said yes. You know, they were having some kind of conversation about consent, but a lot of them struggled with some of the more nuanced issues, right? And also just kind of feeling that, you know, maybe there were things that they didn't know that they didn't know, right? They were like, oh, I have all the talking points, but at the end of the day, they were struggling. So that's chapter one. Chapter two is consent at home and in school, why we need both. And, you know, this talks a lot about how the media influences our children, even if we as parents are saying, you know, I talk about this stuff with my kids. And we're very clear on, you know, what we believe and what we expect. But you have the rest of society to contend with, right? And that's incredibly challenging when they're telling them something different. And that's also, we talk about the continuum of harm, how these messages are subliminal and seep in and then lead to bigger forms of abuse and action. And also why schools are so, so important, because even though we would love to think that, you know, all families, all children are going home after school to loving people who totally believe consent and bodily autonomy are important, the reality is they're not, right? Some will and many, many won't. And so schools have to be a place where these conversations are had as well. You can't just hope that all parents take up this mantle. And so then chapter three, we talk about a little bit more of, again, the sociocultural dynamics, and that chapter is called Entitlement, Boundaries, and Personal Agency. So we talk about something that I know you guys have discussed a lot, things like the concept of childism, right, having bias against children, so that when children report, we're, as a society, even less likely to believe them. And that we often think, well, you know, this trauma can't be that bad, or they'll bounce back, children are resilient, or all these different things that are really prejudiced against children and their experiences. And chapter four, we look at the cultural aspect. So that one's called Decolonizing the Way We Talk About Consent, Cultural Humility, and Sexual Scripting. So this talks about how culture plays into all of these conversations. Chapter five is teaching consent.
Dr. Lauren?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you put the word consent into your define it, describe it, put it in context of your book? Consent.
Yes.
Yeah.
So consent is a concept that is based on a holistic understanding of personal agency, respect, and autonomy, right? So what does that mean even, right? It means that every single person is born with an inalienable right to their own body, to their own mind, their own spirit, and that any action that they engage in has to be something that they are enthusiastically and freely saying yes to.
Okay, that's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's,
I like that.
It's a powerful concept, right? Because it's not just about, you know, people will say, oh, consent's about adults having sex, and that's not true.
Yeah.
It's true,
you know,
in that context, but it's not true. It's only in that context.
You know what it makes me think about when you talk, when you say this, when you gave that definition and gave this about children? It makes me think that eventually the United Nations is going to have to step in, because they're about the humanitarian rights of children, and we don't even have that in America. We don't hear about humanitarianism in America. We really don't. We've lost that. We're almost like a third world country now when it comes to children being abused and women being domestically violent and men, and, you know, we really are. We're not addressing it. And it's so horrendous. You know, trafficking. I mean, we're just not addressing it. And you're talking about, you know, the deep thing of consent that, you know, it's just basic human, am I on the right track?
You are. You are absolutely. This is a human right. And you know, interestingly, I do know the United Nations has touched on it a bit, but, you know, the United Nations can put things out there, but countries don't have to abide by them, right?
Oh, okay.
And I think that's where we have a huge struggle is they can say all day, children have rights. They need to, you know, be respected. They need to be acknowledged. They need to be believed. And individual systems, countries, states, they can say, well, we don't care. They don't have to, you know, follow that. And I think that's one of the biggest ongoing challenges is getting people to understand this and care.
Right. Before
yeah.
America implodes and rots. That's what I keep thinking. Society's going to eventually rot if we keep on abusing our children and keep on beating up people in the family. I mean, it's terrorism, you know?
Yeah.
I just get angry
that's
when the nation doesn't care. well, I'm a couple of semesters away from a master's in Homeland Security, and I want my thesis to be that convicted predators of children, convicted child abusers would be labeled enemy combatants against the homeland and lose their citizenship and have to be sent to another country like Guantanamo Bay or something.
Wow.
But they wouldn't be tried in a civil or criminal court. They'd be tried as a criminal, you know, like war criminals, war crimes, a war tribunal, you know, because they're acting like against children, they're bringing a war against a child.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was just going to say, in a similar way to terrorism, it, becomes something that impacts the entire community.
Yeah, I felt like a POW when I was living with this monster that my mother married. He used to beat us with the belt, stand us in the corner. If we fell asleep, we'd get beat. He used to keep us in the bathtub freezing to death. He just did all kinds of monstrous things to us. You know, I was four, my little sister was three, and my other one was one, and he was horrible. Tell me that's not what POWs go through in a torture, in war. You know, they torture them.
Mm-hmm.
But they torture them for a purpose. But the abuser doesn't even have a purpose for torturing.
Yes.
But we're getting
deep,
so I don't know if we want to get this deep, but before we go on, can I bring Penelope on to say something?
Yes.
I'm sure she's chomping at the bit. Penelope, what do you have to say so far about all this?
I am. Well, what a great discussion that you've had so far, and my gosh, Dr. Laura G. McGuire, wow. I wish we could clone you and have, like, you know, you in every, you know, pediatric office as a specialist, right? When these kids are so young, to start this education so much earlier. And I think that's really, as I'm thinking about, you know, the titles of your chapters and the discussions that you're having, I'm thinking about, you know, not only my own experiences, but, you know, my children, right? And I agree with Pamela. I don't really think that times have changed all that much in terms of, you know, children being treated as property, especially within the home, versus as having individual rights. And the child growing up in an abusive environment, I was born into it. It was just, the world was, we did not have a right to a voice, right? Abuse was the norm. This is what we knew. We did not have the right to have self-advocacy. There was no agency. And so that whole consent, that wasn't even a word that we would have understood what that even meant by definition or in practice. So the whole concept of consent, you know, definitely wasn't introduced in the home. And this is, of course, you know, I was, you know, in elementary school in the late 70s and then middle school in the, you know, 80s and late 80s. But my question is, I guess my comment is too, is that I look at my own children now. Of course, I've got one that's now entering a junior year in college. I've got a junior and senior in high school, but been very closely involved in the curriculum, especially when it comes to FLASH, right, when they start talking about human sexuality. And still, like, they brush upon consent, but they're very light, right, with, you know, really all issues that relating to abuse, whether it's, you know, child abuse, child sexual abuse, domestic violence. And to me, and I know we don't, there's no federal mandate of what is on the FLASH curriculum, to my knowledge. And so, you know, I guess my question is, how do we make change to just get the whole language of consent, you know, and the whole concept of consent within the understanding of young children, right? So they can apply that concept both, you know, in their home environment and in their, you know, school environment, their peer environment, and also for, you know, adults who are responsible for reporting, right? And, well, for conducting, you know, having a home conducive to consent, right? And also just informing when we see, or, you know, right now it's a mandatory reporter that can get anybody's attention if there's anything going on. So, you know, how do we also, you know, give, I think, change that, you know, structure of accountability? And so I know it's a lot I'm putting out there, but as you're talking and I'm thinking about this, these are the areas where, you know, there, I think that there's, it's such a big nut to crack, but, you know, areas that I'm thinking of as you're talking about that I'm going, wow, you know, there's just so much work to do.
Yeah.
And how do we get it done?
Yes. Oh, I mean, that's, you know, it's such a big question, but I think at the end of the day, one of my hopes with, you know, the book and teaching people and talking to folks like we're doing tonight is that they realize the truth of the matter is that it is a big topic. It is complex because human beings are complex, but it is not infeasible, right? It's not something we can't do. It's really just an investment in learning and unlearning. So in particular, when you talk about parents or teachers talking about these subjects, a lot of times, as you mentioned, they have not had any exposure to what this really means for them, how they would define these terms. That might be something that's completely out of their realm of knowledge at that moment. And so we need to acknowledge that and appreciate that. And so I try to also talk about not only should students be getting this at all, you know, grades, at all ages, in some form or another, having them have this discussion, but parents need to have access to learning about consent and understanding their children and identifying abuse and such themselves. Because if the student is getting it in school and they're going home and they're saying to their parents, hey, do you know that, you know, we learned today this isn't okay, and we learned that I can say no, we learned that if someone does something like this that, you know, I have to tell someone, et cetera. And if they really are getting older and they're getting into more of the dynamics of what that looks like and all of the aspects of healthy relationships and communication, et cetera, their parents might say, I don't know what you're talking about, or, you know, that sounds really confusing or scary to me even, and counteract those messages. So they need to also be going to homes where the parents have had exposure to what their young people are learning and reiterating that instead. And I think, you know, like you're saying with the curriculum, I talk about cross-curricular design, and it's so, so important that this isn't just something we say for health class at one point in their life, or maybe twice if they're super lucky, and then we drop it, right? It needs to be an ongoing, regular conversation, the way we have Awareness Month, right? And how many times in school did you learn some aspect about the Civil War or some aspect of fractions, right? A million times, over and over and over again throughout your you know, K-12 experience. Why isn't it the same thing with, you know, and I talk about consent, but that has to do with everything from domestic violence to human trafficking to bodily autonomy to respect and boundaries, right? Why isn't some form of that given every single year the same way fractions in the Civil War are? That's
absolutely.
My goal.
And you know, that brings to mind Aaron's Law. You've heard of Aaron's Law, right?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of Aaron's Law? Yeah, where she wants, she's got it in 30-something states right now about teaching children about, you know, unsafe touches and unsafe secrets, that they learn about it, you know, from K to 12th grade every year. But there's no curriculum for it, so they can't put it in. Okay, so it's there on the law books, but it's not able to be incorporated in the school. I want to stop here. Thank you, Penelope. Darlene has come on board with us. Darlene, from Tennessee, she's one of our ambassadors at NAFTA. She's ambassador for Tennessee. Darlene, have you been listening? Do you have anything, a comment or question for Dr. Laura?
Well, I like the fact that she is stating the fact how sex abuse is taboo and was taboo to talk about. It still seems like it is today with so many people like, I don't want to hear it. But if you talk about that when you see a case on the TV or something in the news about that happening to some kid right now, then they're all about wanting to help. But then that you're an adult and everything, it's like, well, that's normal. You know what I mean? And they just shirk it off, and it's not normal. It's very dysfunctional, very toxic, and it not only scars the mind, it makes you feel nasty, it makes you distrust, it does affect you sometimes the rest of your life and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, and she's all about teaching us about that. She's a sexologist, and so she teaches us, and she's been talking about her book, and she's up to chapter 4, I believe. Darlene, do you have any other question or comment before we get back to her book?
It sounds pretty interesting. I got in a little bit late, and I meant to call in at 7, and I didn't have my timer set. So I guess I should have set my timer, you know. Oh, boy.
Thank you, Darlene.
You're welcome.
Hold on. You're going to hear some more and have some comments and questions for Dr. Laura. Thank you.
Okay.
All right, Dr. Laura, chapter 4. I think you were talking.
Yes. Right. So, yes, chapter 4, like I said, is talking about culture and how we infuse cultural narratives and inclusion into consent conversations. And then chapter 5 is teaching consent, curriculum design, and diffusion. So how do we teach consent from an emotional quota standpoint? So using emotional intelligence principles as some of the cornerstones of this conversation. And then I talk a lot about some of the learning theories. So different aspects on how values are learned, because ultimately all these things we're talking about are values-based narratives and lessons, right? So we're not just teaching young people, well, here are the rules or here's what to watch out for. We're telling them this is a value we want to uphold, which is safety and respect and all the things that go along with that. And so how do we do that in an impactful way? And chapter 6 is about gender responsive frameworks. So looking at how gender further has implications on survivor experiences and discussions around power dynamics and respect and autonomy. And then chapter 7 is the last chapter, which is the future we create. So talking about all the things that we discuss in the book, what are the next steps? Because one of my pet peeves as an educator and as a survivor is sometimes I'll go to, you know, conferences or there'll be a speaker somewhere, and they'll just focus on the problem. They'll tell us all the terrible stuff that's going on. And I'm like, well, what do we do about it? You have to give us action steps as to how to address this in our everyday lives. Or otherwise, what was the point? Except I'm sad now, you know? Even for as a survivor, sometimes it's super triggering. You know, I can't always sit through those talks because they will bring up so many negative memories for me and really leave me shaken, you know, for weeks afterwards. So I don't like to focus on that. I like to focus on, well, what are the solutions? What if we know there's a problem, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do as individuals and as, you know, systems and communities? What can we do? And so that's really where we conclude is, you know, wherever you are, whoever you are, whether you're a parent or a teacher or a principal or a student, maybe you're a student who's listening to this and saying, oh my gosh, I want this in my school, I want these programs in my school, then you have a voice. You need to use it, you know? Just because you're a young person doesn't mean you can't advocate for curriculum change and having consent education be mandatory in your school. You absolutely can and you should. So, yeah, that's really where we go with the conversation.
That's awesome. I really like your book. Is it really pretty deep? I mean, for, you know, like, say I've only got, you know, high school education, can I understand it, or how did you write it?
Thank you for saying that, actually, because this isn't something I've gotten to talk about a lot yet. I very intentionally wrote this one to be something that people did not need any kind of special training or education or exposure for. It's very introductory. So even though we talk about a lot of different big topics, it's written, you know, at a kind of language and grammatic level. Like the structure itself of the writing is for somebody who, like you're saying, maybe just finished high school, maybe not even that, that they could really grasp what we're talking about and get an introduction to these different topics. In there's still like some conversation about, well, what does research tell us? And like I said, some learning theories and stuff, but it's very, very approachable. It's not something that people are gonna, it's also not a huge book, right? They're not gonna pick it up and say, oh my gosh, I need to go back to school to understand this. Really, truly, it's for the general population. That was our goal.
Yeah. And it's not like graphic or anything like that, right?
No.
Okay. So the reason I was saying that is because, you know, like in colleges, you know, they have like family consumer degrees and stuff like that. You could get your book in colleges because, you know, about, you know, family, you know, where they teach about this kind of stuff in colleges. I don't know. I guess sociology might be a department you can get your book into. Certainly social work, you know. For social workers to understand it. And the psychology department, you know. Because, you know, a lot of times colleges is where these people need to study this, you know. We've got to get it in somewhere where it can be mass communicated.
Exactly.
What do you think about the book, Penelope?
Well, I mean, I think it should be required reading, you know, obviously, I think for anybody that's interacting with children and teaching children, I think it should be required reading for parents. But honestly, I don't know why we don't, you know, we don't educate anyone who's touching children from a young age and educating children or assessing children from a medical standpoint, why this is not a continuing ed requirement. So, I mean, that's really what's going through my head. I'm trauma-informed trained and, you know, the line of work that I do. And so, you know, now that I have that awareness, I bring that into my teaching every single day. But until I knew what to look for and what that was, it wasn't even on my mind, right? I'm an educator myself. So, I mean, I'm really thinking about the book because I feel like, you know, it should be something that is, you know, that is somehow brought into a requirement across so many different boards. I mean, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that about being trauma-informed trained as well.
Yeah, so many different genres. Dr. Lore, I'm going to ask you to do something that's going to, it might be easy for you, then again, I don't know. But I want you to take that book and the chapters you just went over and say I just sent it to a teacher who's working with children that are risk area. What can that teacher get out of that book to help those at-risk children that she's teaching?
Mm, That's such a good question. Yeah, I think that for teachers in particular, they're going to get a lot of ideas for how to have these conversations at different grade levels. There's even question prompts in there, you know, what is something I could ask students in my class? And what are different, you know, ways that I can infuse this in the curriculum throughout the year? Because, I think, Penelope, you know, one of the things that you brought up is as a K-12 teacher, because that's what I was for many years, we don't get any training on, you know, on talking about these things or identifying these things in the children we work with unless we speak it out, right? It's not part of our teacher training. We get classroom management and differentiation to make the curriculum engaging to different students. And that's all good. That's all great. But my goodness, and you talked about human trafficking too. I mean, that's such an important topic, but why are teachers not learning to identify potential trafficking behaviors or, you know, things that their students might be demonstrating that are pointing to that might be experience that they're going through? There's a little bit on child abuse reporting, a tiny bit, but mostly it's, you know, if a child has a bruise, you know, you should ask them how they got it or something like that. It's not how do we prevent this? How do we identify this on a larger scale? How do we also work with children who may have been removed from an abusive situation but are still severely traumatized, right, and are not going to be having the same classroom experience as a child who's not? So I think it should absolutely be part of teacher training preparation across the board, every state, and professional development for teachers as well. And like you're saying, there's so many industries that need this. I actually started doing recently a trauma-informed certification for lawyers and legal professionals as well, because that's another area where, okay, now you reported, you know, especially if it's in civil court, you know, you're not going to get even the same kinds of judges sometimes with the same exposure to discussion trauma, and in criminal court as well. And so a lot of times it stops there, doesn't go anywhere, because they don't have this awareness either. They've been told the opposite. They've been told to try to discredit people, especially young people. And so the more we speak out, the more we train, the more we engage people in investing in this. That's the other big thing, is not just here's information, but please invest your heart, your life, your practice into doing these things, because that's the only way we can really change.
Right.
Well, and
Dr.
Also,
Laura, this
I was also going to say, I think maybe, you know, I was thinking, well, gosh, you know, most teachers, I mean, and maybe most schools have gone back to in-person learning, but most teachers were spending their time just getting up to speed on how to use Zoom or Teams and how to use Canvas and, you know, really have kind of their eye not on the, you know, not on the prize, so to speak, but just trying to get to the curriculum the best they can with, you know, their own learning curve. But it also might be an opportunity to say, listen, I mean, whether your, you know, students are in person or you're having to stream your class remotely, for those remote students, here's what you really have to, you know, here's maybe it's an opportunity just to totally retrain and bring different, you know, bring that awareness, right, into the mix, because we're, you know, we're really having to be more discerning as educators to really try and see how our students are doing, right? We have to actually have more attention on them now that they're, you know, when they're in the remote environment. We're having to, you know, tell ourselves, at least I am, to start looking for things because we're not seeing them face to face. I think you have to be a little bit more discerning when they're on a video screen if they choose to turn on their camera. And maybe never choosing to turn on their camera is also another sign of something happening, right?
Yes, that's such a good point.
Thank you, Penelope.
Some thoughts there.
I want to go to Darlene. I don't want her to feel left out because we have big mouths, don't we, Penelope?
We do.
Penelope's like, you do, I don't.
No, okay, I do. Darlene. I do. It's fine.
Okay, Darlene. You're on.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Darlene?
Hey. Yes.
Yes. I am, I do the Zoom meetings on Tuesdays for Bill, you know, for the NASCAR group. And that's not one of the requirements, you know, about putting a camera on. Because some people don't feel like turning their camera on. And that's okay with me. You know, I don't think nothing about them, whether they got a problem going on right then and there or nothing, you know. I just accept it. Well, today they don't feel like putting their camera on, you know. Or if they don't feel like putting a camera on, it's okay because that's not one of the requirements, you know. If they don't feel like talking, that's okay too, but they'll know that they got support because they end up texting us and stuff, you know. So I think any little bit that these people are reaching out, that's great, you know, whether you're on camera, off camera, whether you want to talk on a microphone, don't want to talk on a microphone. Some of them just got to wait and see if the group can be trusted because this is such a delicate topic.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, it is delicate, and I think that's also one of the reasons people are sometimes afraid to approach it. You know, I've even had teachers say, I don't want kids to, you know, disclose to me because I don't know what I'll do. Or I don't know how to handle that, or that will be really scary and stressful. And, you know, and that's heartbreaking because instead they should be saying, I want to make sure students feel safe to disclose to me because, yes, it will be hot, maybe harder upsetting for me, but my goodness, it's 10 million times worse for that child, and I don't want any child to ever, you know, not take the opportunity to speak up and share if something's not right. So
if they hear anything, anybody says something sick, like, oh, that turns me on to hear a child being, and like one guy on the internet had told me before, this was way before NASCAR and all, you know, and he told me that if anybody says that the, hearing about a child being raped or molested does not turn them on, they're lying. And I think that's very sick.
Was sick, definitely.
So definitely that person became a used-to-be friend, you know. That ain't one I keep on my friend list. But, you know, just when you're out starting to tell your story, it gets kind of hard because you end up meeting pedophiles like this, too, on the Internet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you, Darlene. Okay.
Thank you.
Before we get back to your... Yeah, before we get back to your story, Dr. Laura, I have one more comment that I want you to comment on. I think, being a social worker, I think, you know how, well, I used to do this when I was younger in school. I had to check people for scoliosis. They would bend over and you'd look at the spine and you'd see, you know, if the spine was crooked or whatever. And you know, that was a thing you did every year on the kids. Also, hearing tests. Don't you think we should have some kind of psychological testing for children coming into the school every year? Standard.
No, I think that's a really good point. Where yeah, we'll check for lice, we'll check for scoliosis, but do we check for abuse? Right. And I think that's definitely something that has to be handled by absolute professionals. Right. It would be a very, very delicate matter. But just having people who regularly talk to kids, I know we have like guidance counselors, but they rarely see every single child. Right. They'll only see them if they're referred to them. But instead to have, like, you know, where they might have one-on-one time talking about, you know, introducing them to the classroom and school and expectations, but then talking to them about their home life. And, again, if they're trained experts, they can notice hesitation with answering certain questions or maybe answers that raise concerns, that then that's something that they can be aware of and look into. and, you know, just make sure that that child is really being supported and, you know, I don't want to say, you know, on their radar exactly, but if there's any red flags, like we say pink flags even, something that's just a little like, well, I don't know if that's a negative situation or not, but I want to make sure we follow up with the student in particular. And right, in every single year, because 1 year to the next, a child's behavior will change, right? And this kind of goes back to Penelope and I talking about what we learn as teachers. We learn about classroom management, but rarely in that conversation do we talk about, well, if a student is misbehaving in class, if they're being aggressive, if they're breaking down in tears all the time, if they're refusing to engage, well, a lot of those things are signs of trauma, right? And we're only taught to manage it and get them under control and get them to participate. We're not looking at often, well, my goodness, what is the story there? There's probably something much bigger that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, they've been medicating the problem, and that's ridiculous. To medicate a child because they're misbehaving, because of trauma. Well, if the trauma doesn't go away, they're medicated, and that's just more trauma on trauma, really. And, you know, I just think as a social worker, my idea is once or maybe even twice a year during the school year that children have looking for abuse, but just a baseline mental health physical, you know, they have a medical physical. Well, not a mental health physical, you know, if you're looking for abuse. Go, Penelope.
Well, to your point, I mean, you know, a lot of kids play athletics, and in order to play athletics in the school system, you have to, you know, fill out all the forms, and you have to submit your physician, you know, your physical. You know, they could very easily have the child also have to fill out, you know, a mental health, you know, have a mental health professional fill out a form. I mean, they could have an assessment done. And a lot of kids play sports, so a lot of kids go get those physicals because they know they've got to get them in to play sports. I mean, I just think, you know, you're right. But I think it's how they, you know, how can you pass the mandate through? And I hear what, you know, Dr. McGuire is saying, because these schools, especially the larger public schools, I mean, even though they have on-site counselors, they don't have the bandwidth, right, to really assess all these students critically the way that they should be. There's just too many students. You know, there's just not enough infrastructure, in my opinion, built into the schools to really, you know, properly assess all of them.
Well, they have, Penelope, they have their own medical doctor. Why can't they go to a mental health professional? Their own,
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that the kids, they should. If they, you know, they go to their medical doctor to get their physical, they have to do that to play sports. You can't play it without that physical form turned in. Well, all the schools have to do is mandate that they also, you know, go see a mental health professional and also fill in that, you know, submit that assessment form. And kids, trust me, they're motivated.
Well,
they want to play sports. Their parents want them to play sports, you know.
Yeah.
We're Johnny on the spot with all those forms. So, but I think it's just how do you get that to be a process, within the process, to recognize how important that is.
Yeah. We'll get there soon. As soon as one of the senator's kids is killed by a Columbine-type person, we'll get there. I promise you.
Yeah, you're right. That's true.
It's gonna take a high political office person to have to feel what we feel in the lower echelon. So I'm going to be quiet. Dr. Laura, this is your show.
No, it's okay. I only have like 2 minutes left. I have to take off and get my family ready for bed. But it was so nice talking to you guys. Is there any final questions that I can answer before I head out?
You said that you have a magazine that you talk about where you address sexuality questions? Go ahead.
I write a lot for a couple of different magazines where people put in questions, and a lot of them have to do with this kind of thing, particularly for adults asking questions about, you know, after they have survived trauma, how do they process that? How do they reconnect with their body and have healthy relationships in the future? And so that's another huge passion of mine, because there are so many resources, I feel, for when people are in a state of crisis, right? But not as many for, well, what about the years that come after? So that's one of my passions as well, is making sure there are resources for that.
So how do you interface with somebody that's trauma, that had childhood trauma, and they're having sexual problems in their relationship, in their love life, or in their trying to find love?
Yeah, so I sometimes actually offer workshops on this for the general public. But another thing is, people can reach out to me, and if they're interested, I do some coaching. And a lot of that is to kind of identify what's happened in their life, where they are now, and where they want to be, and then connect them with further resources to get there, you know, whether that's books to read, therapists to work with long-term, even just like things like journaling, exercises, mantras, all that stuff to create an environment where they can identify what they want the future to look like and what those next steps would be. So I would definitely encourage people to reach out to me directly. They can find me at drlauramaguire.com. And, yeah, I love to answer any questions I have and offer any further resources or work with people one-on-one.
Some hope about leave us with some hope about where you think our country needs to go with everything about this, all this sexual stuff coming out, sexual trauma, domestic violence, you know, all these sports people, you know, not just sports people, Hollywood people, all these people. Where do you think America is going with all this?
So the message of hope that I would say is that the more we hear about things, we have to take heart that the more issues that have been around for generations and covered up, the more they're coming to light. And the more that something comes to the surface, yes, it's painful, yes, it's terrible to think about, and then that leads to us having to acknowledge how widespread it is, but it's the only way that we can effectively address and heal from and prevent and do all of the things that we're trying to do, you know, impactfully. We have to hear about it and acknowledge it, and in order to address it. So take heart that when you see these terrible stories, that it's something that has been going on long before that individual situation. And the more we talk about it, the better we can prevent it in the future.
That's perfect. Can I go down the panel one more time before we close?
Sure.
And let Penelope, do you have anything you want to comment or say to Dr. Laura before she leaves?
No, I just want to thank her for, you know, being here this evening as our, you know, an expert in this area, which I think obviously needs a lot of more discussion, a lot more, you know, implementation and awareness. And thank you for, you know, providing yourself as a resource and your book. And just, I just wish to say thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. All right, Darlene.
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for coming and doing this today. And I just seen something interesting on the news on the Tennessee Gov site, and hopefully we'll be able to talk about this more after you go as well. You know, because I think this will be a good subject, you know, to continue on this time when you go. You know, but the Tennessee Department of Education selected 176 schools for new trauma-informed schools cohort. and that was April 29th, 2021, and I think that is awesome.
Wow. That is.
Yeah, I'd like to read it in a few minutes, you know, but I know you ain't got time right now, so.
Yeah, can you send Dr. Laura and Penelope and myself the link to what you're talking about?
Okay, I will try to see if I can send this link or do my best.
Okay. Well, Dr. Laura.
It's it. EDU. Oh, never mind. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, that sounds great. And actually, I was going to say, I'm actually from Tennessee. So I would love to hear more about that and hopefully get involved because that's really exciting.
Oh, cool. So, I'm a NASCA master, so I like to talk further with you sometime, too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, Tennessee.
Thank you all for having me.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Well, Dr. Laura from NASCA and all of us from Pamela, Penelope, and Darlene, we thank you so much for being on the show. We thank you for answering our questions, making comments on our comments, and tell us how to get your book before you go.
Yes, people can find Creating Cultures of Consent on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble if they request it, and it's through Roman and Littlefield Publishing House. And so, yeah, you can find it pretty much anywhere books are sold.
Is it in an e-book as well?
Yes, there is a digital version as well.
Okay. All righty. Well, we tell you thank you and good night and take care of your family.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I just went ahead and I put that link in the NASCA chatters that you got.
Yeah.
Perfect. I put it in there so I don't have to send it to a lot of different people, but maybe you'll be able to send it to her, you know. Maybe Penelope,
awesome.
If you're in that group, maybe you'll be able to see it as well.
Yeah, let me take a see if I can find it now since you just posted it. That's a great idea.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
What did it say again, Darlene? Can you read it slowly? What the headline was?
Okay, it says TDOE, that means Tennessee Department of Education, selects 176 schools for new trauma-informed schools cohort. And that was back in 2021, April 29th. And it said, today the Tennessee Department of Education is pleased to announce 176 schools were selected for the second cohort of trauma-informed schools in Tennessee. This new cohort more than doubles the original 73 schools from the first trauma-informed schools cohort, which launched in 2018-2019. In Tennessee, the model trauma-informed school designation recognizes schools for their emphasis on implementing trauma-informed strategies to provide critical support for students. Schools implementing trauma-informed approaches have seen improvements in school climate, attendance, and teacher satisfaction, while seeing a reduction in suspicions and expulsions, stress for staff and students, and more. To view the full list of the new cohort trauma-informed schools, it says click here. But y'all got the link where y'all being able to click there, okay? It says like each student, each school community is special and unique, and schools that implement trauma-informed strategies are helping to ensure students receive the academic and non-academic supports they need. The department is thrilled to be able to more than double the number of trauma-informed schools in the state to help provide school officials, teachers, and staff with training and resources to help all students reach their full potential. Sorry. Our school has become a true safe haven for students in our district. That is very important, that statement right there alone, you know. With a trauma-informed mindset, teachers can take advantage of the opportunity to demonstrate true through kindness and love to students and family. It says the culture of school that embeds trauma and fornication in all aspects of its daily activities can be exhilarating, and lives will be changed, and genuine partnerships will be formed between students and school faculty / staff. Our goal is to help students feel safe, loved, and know they can trust us. Through the application process, which got a link that people could click on to try to get their schools in that, you know, which that might lead to a different state. I don't really know. I hadn't checked it out yet, okay? The trauma-informed school approach has made a huge impact on students and the overall success. It has helped build trust and strengthen relationships between our educators and students by improving our overall school culture.
Awesome.
That's it.
And the word cohort. The word cohort is usually used in the context of research, which means they're probably, this is probably a pilot program where they're going to research how this works out. And if it works, it'll be evidence-based and entered into other schools in the nation. So this is awesome.
Yes, they said that it was like, did they say 73 schools the first time, and this time it's 176 or something like that. So it grew from last year to this year. It's grown.
Right. So they're
good.
They're making
awesome.
Yeah, they're expanding the research because they found that the first research pilot study probably worked out very well. So this is awesome news. Thank you, Darlene.
Yeah.
Penelope, what do you have to say about it? Oh, Darlene,
well, I mean,
did you get finished? Well, let me see, Darlene, or did you have something else to say?
No, I'm fine right now.
Okay, Penelope?
It's a great start, and it's encouraging, you know. I mean, I know we're not going to, you know, move the mountain overnight, but we've got to start somewhere, you know, so.
Absolutely.
It's a little overwhelming. A little overwhelming, and I keep going, you know, it's not really my own experience, but, you know, my kids are still school age, and I'm thinking about, you know, kind of the current state, right, and where we need to get to.
Right.
And we will get there. You know, I was actually about this today before the, you know, before the show. I know that we'll get there. We've gotten there with so many other issues that needed to come to the forefront. We've made a lot of progress in the last, you know, the last several years. I just still feel that, you know, the issue of child abuse, the issue of, you know, domestic violence and of, you know, consent, I mean, these are just, I feel like these are some of the last to come to the table. So it's a start, but I just, you know, I have some frustration, but I also have some hope because we're better than the way we're serving our children now in this area. I know that we're better than that.
Right.
We'll get there. So, I, you know, thank you, darling, because that is hopeful. You know, it is hopeful.
Where good news comes up, we need to share it with one another. We need to share it with our listeners so that they can go and find, you know, where this hope is coming from. And I want to go research and find out from where the study was, what results came from the study of 2018 through 2019, Darlene, when it was first done?
Yeah, I did.
Darlene.
And so that led, yeah, I read the thing and it said the study had shown that it brought the teachers and the students closer and had less expulsions, less people start trouble, and they could actually show students they were loved in a safe environment. You know what I mean? Without worrying about being racially abused or sexually assaulted. So that's what the first one proved. So this is the second year of doing it, April last year. So, you know, most of that was, you know, they probably didn't get to implement as much because of the pandemic and schools were out. Now schools were back in force this year. So it'd be interesting to see because we know that the people that's being abused, the survivors, the victims and stuff, they're having to be at home with these stupid pedophiles. And I'm sorry I'm calling them stupid pedophiles, right, but they are stupid for her even thinking about the crazy thoughts like that that comes into their head. They're cowards, too. They're not brave.
Yes.
They're not, they're sick and they're cowardly. They wouldn't hide this, you know, if they were brave, right? They do it out in the open and say, come get me, you know. But they don't. They hide it because they are cowards. And for a grown man or person to take the sexual innocence of a child or the just innocence through any kind of abuse is showing them for what they are, cowards, right?
Well,
and these
people,
y'all do not deserve it. I want y'all to know you do not deserve being abused.
No. And I don't want to minimize the trial or the results, you know, or the study subjects at all. I don't mean to minimize that. I mean, that is progress, and we've got proof, right? There's now some proof. We need to do something with that proof. I mean, how much proof, you know, how many studies like this is going to take to really get, you know, to take action, right, and to pull it through and to start, you know, and to start making some changes and some movement. I mean, it's hopeful because we've got the evidence. I mean, we need to pull it through, you know.
Well, see, they are getting trained, too, so to be trauma-informed. So they have been, you know what I mean? So that is a very plus. That's a plus.
Now, Darlene, did this take legislation to get into the school at all? How did it get in? Was it legislated in or what?
I'm not really sure because this was kind of like, I guess, like a trial type of thing for the Tennessee Department of Education to be able to implement that and choose 176 schools per se, I think, that had to be put in maybe under a trial type of thing. Maybe I just now had just found it. So all I know is just all I see. That's all I know at the moment, you know. You know, and I said, this is
then
good news.
Then what we need to do is NASCA members is to take that stuff from the Tennessee Department of Education to each of our state departments of education and show the study to them. That's simple as that.
Right, exactly.
So I'd like to learn more because I'll take it to my Louisiana Department of Education and
that's
talk
awesome.
With the man that's head of it.
Yeah. You can probably print it off, you know, and show them, you know.
Oh, definitely, yeah. So we're back. We're 6 minutes till the end of the show. Does anybody have anything they want to bring up, another topic or something they want, an issue you want to bring up? Penelope, you go first. Is there anything?
No, I think, you know, one thing that's top of mind, it's a really big nut, but, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, we do things state by state a lot of times. And what does it take to get something that's, you know, comes down federally, right? How do we implement, you know, change? How do we keep our children safe? You know, how do we do all these things to help give our children these rights they deserve and keep our children safe swiftly? And how do we mandate some of these things or bring some of these things in to, you know, the school system, you know, not piece by piece, you know, but it's wholly, you know, as a country. That's where my frustration lies, because you know you look, and I don't know how many, you know, when you look at the school system, and I'm not as familiar with it. I'm only familiar with the little, you know, the school system that I work within. And you look, you know, nationally, you know, how do you, you know, get these mandates or get these curriculums that are mandated on a federal level, right, into the schools and get them implemented. what does it take?
Yeah.
Big question, but I guess I have to start at the top, you know, and have someone tell me no. I'll go down the ladder, but I want to start at the very top, and I want it all. I'm a high-maintenance woman, you know. Why not?
All right. Penelope, that's your homework, okay? Next time I talk to you, you come on as co-host, you tell us the answer to that question.
You're going to be on the top, Penelope.
But that, Darlene? Yeah, right, exactly.
Darlene, you had something to say?
I was going to say something else, but I'm just leaving it. In this day and time, a lot of people have lost a lot of hope and do not see the bright end of things. And if you take that information I just gave you, but there shows hope alone. So we got to live with it and not just sit back, idly back, wait on everybody to get it done. Sometimes it might be them that need to step a little bit forward and try to get this implemented in their wherever they're at, too.
Right. And look, I'm thinking what you just talked about, and y'all see if you agree, is that this may be a back door into finding abuse of children. You understand what I'm saying? When the teachers begin loving these children and treating these children with respect, the light bulb's going to go off and they're going to say, why am I not getting this at home? You understand what I'm saying? And it's going to be a back door into child abuse, I think.
Well, it's already happening. It's already happening. That's what I'm saying. It's already happening.
And I agree.
Usually would normally start a conflict instead because it's got trauma type informed. Now they're able to, you know, do some things and all, you know, get their studies done and everything. And I think they probably ended up getting them out of that hectic situation at times, you know. I hope and pray they did, you know.
Awesome. Well, we've got 2 minutes, so, well, actually 1 minute. So anybody got anything quick for a minute?
You do.
Huh?
I said you do.
A point. Anybody want to sing? Anybody get a point? Oh, boy. Okay.
I do agree with you.
I was about to say that Zoom meeting is going to be tomorrow at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. So for trauma survivors, please come to the Zoom meeting and everybody support each other. It's not one that we are there to condemn one another. It's there as supporters.
Right.
So
well,
Darlene,
I'll see you on
Yeah, I'll be over there tomorrow. I won't be the leader tomorrow. It will be Muriel and Jose. They'll be the two people.
Right. Well, will you text me, private message me beforehand so I can get my makeup on?
Sure.
Okay. Well, let's say goodnight, everybody.
Good night.
Melody, what is your
good night, John Boy.
Good night, everyone.
John Boy.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, Penelope.
Yeah. Penelope, do you have anything?
No, I just wanted to say thank you and good night, everyone. And, you know, the responsibility falls on the adults.
Right.
You know, if you see something, say something, get involved.
Right. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. We got to remind people that
Blog Talk Radio.
Voluntarily change everything.